Today we welcome Dr. James Bernard Matchin, to me, Bernie Matchin, also by which he's known usually at the University of Utah. President of the university, it's been some time since the president of the School to the North has been here to address our student body. But we're very pleased to have him. He's made a remarkable difference at the University of Utah, and he bestows an honor upon us by accepting our invitation today. I'm reasonably certain that as you BYU students and faculty considered his appearance today, you couldn't help but admire his daring and venturesome nature, particularly after last night's game. Here he is in the very same arena where last evening two rival basketball teams of the two universities squared off in their first meeting of the season. And I must say it was nice to have a win for Brigham Young University after they have beaten us for the last five straight years here. We do not intend that to happen again. Can you imagine the thoughts which must have crossed his mind at least occasionally yesterday, wondering whether he'd be walking in here today as the president of the conquerors or the president of the vanquished? Of course, he might say that he knew all along that the outcome was sure, and he was in a low-risk undertaking. Whatever those pre-appearance thoughts and feelings, we take delight in having him with us today. Dr. Matchin has identified a theme for his remarks which should be of interest to our entire university community. His extensive experience as an academic and as a university administrator has made him extremely well qualified to address the topic. He has studied, taught, and or been an administrator at a number of leading universities across the nation. He obtained his DDDS degree from St. Louis University, subsequently his MS in pediatric dentistry and his PhD in educational psychology from the University of Iowa. He has been honored by his peers in being named as a diplomat of the American Board of Pediatric Dentistry and in being elected as president of the American Association of Dental Schools. He served as professor and associate dean at the University of North Carolina. In 1989, he moved to the University of Michigan as professor and dean of the School of Dentistry. 6 years later, he was asked to accept the responsibility of provost and executive vice president for academic affairs at the University of Michigan. His success in this role at a very difficult time in the university's history made him a candidate for presidential positions at several major institutions of higher learning across the United States. When he was offered the presidency at the University of Utah, both he and his wife, Chris, were happy at the prospect of living in the western United States, where they could participate in activities characteristic of this area. The Matchins constitute a great team in many respects, not the least of which is their ability to help people feel comfortable and accepted as friends. They share a deep commitment to the well-being and success of their three children. As an administrator, Dr. Matchin is known as one who encourages diversity of ideas, a sense of shared responsibility, collaboration, collegiality, and institutional excellence. These values have been evident within the University of Utah from the outset of his administration. When he spoke at his inauguration as president, he highlighted three principles which he felt were critical to the success of the university. One, pursue excellence in everything we do. Two, recognize, accommodate, and celebrate diversity. And three, place academic considerations in position of first priority. Testimonials since then voice support of Dr. Matchin and his work that they clearly affirm these principles guide both his rhetoric and his daily affairs. He walks the walk as well as he talks the talk, and he challenges his colleagues to join him. We welcome you, President Matchin. We delight in the relationship of our two universities, a rivalry on one sense, but a complementarity on the other. We look forward to hearing your message and know we'll be benefited by your presence today. My friend, Bernie, president of the University of Utah.
Good morning, BYU. I've been waiting to say that for some time. It is a pleasure to be here today, but to be completely honest, I much prefer being in the Marriott Center this morning instead of last night. It sort of makes me empathize with Daniel, who visited an equally hostile animal's lair in biblical times. It certainly was a great game, but I have one fresh piece of advice for President Bateman that I hope that he can give careful consideration to: returning to more traditional family home evenings and not schedule any more big Monday night games against the University of Utah. We would like to congratulate the Cougars and say that we are looking forward to February the 24th, when there is a return visit to Salt Lake, which I'm sure will be another very exciting game. This rivalry is very rich and very wholesome, and having been involved in a number of intercollegiate rivalries, I cherish this one above all the others I've had, because I think our university shares so many things on so many different levels, and it's fun to see the students and the alums enjoy this competition in such a friendly and yet wholesome way. In spite of the unpleasantness of last night, I really have been looking forward to being here today. One of the great joys of being a university president is being able to visit with today's young people. Just last Friday, I had the opportunity to address students, faculty, and friends at the LDS Institute of Religion that's adjacent to the University of Utah campus. We broke ground on a new 115,000-square-foot facility. This new complex, the largest institute building project ever undertaken by the church's educational system, will have the capacity to accommodate up to 10,000 students, 2 stakes, and 16 wards. This is a wonderful time for us to be alive. And as we begin a new millennium, I enjoy interacting with you, tomorrow's leaders. Your generation has a real opportunity to solve problems my generation has struggled with in vain. I've never been more optimistic about the future than I am today. It will not surprise you to know that my optimism is rooted in a belief that education is the key to success. Success for our society, as well as success for individuals like each of you. To complement that thought, there's a quote by Plato in the New Republic of 400 BC. The direction in which education starts a man will determine his future life. And with the turning of the century, I have been pondering what being an education person means. Is an educated person in the 21st century any different than an educated person in the 19th or the 20th centuries? What will you young people need in order to be considered educated and successful in life? How is that different from what your parents or your grandparents faced when they were your age? Now, I'm not in the habit of giving advice, especially to bright, talented young people like you. I am reminded of the junior high school student's report on Socrates. In it, the student wrote, "Socrates was a Greek philosopher who went around giving people good advice. They poisoned him." My objective today is a modest one: to offer a few thoughts that might someday be of use. For the next few minutes, let us think about what it means to be an educated person. Perhaps it will help you articulate some of your personal goals and career aspirations. When we consider the concept of an educated person today versus 2 centuries ago, the first realization is that in 1801, 200 years ago, this concept had meaning only for men. The role of women in society was much more confined than today. When I consider the 21st century definition of an educated person, it is essentially gender-free. The roles women can play in this century are unlimited. Access to education is no longer tied to gender, and what makes a person educated has nothing to do with biology. Now, that doesn't mean that there are no differences. Recently, Elder Vaughn Featherstone told an interesting story that highlights how such differences are perceived. A newly married couple was overheard in their kitchen. The husband observed to his wife, "She wasn't able to make bread quite like her mother." Whereupon the new wife rejoined without missing nary a beat, "Yes, and you don't make dough like my dad." In spite of, or maybe I should say, in addition to, the differences between men and women, their education can and should be quite similar. And let us start our list of components for the educated 21st century person with the most obviously needed skill in today's environment. That is technological literacy and the associated emerging applications of information technology. This requirement did not exist as such for my parents, much less for my grandparents. In their time, as noted in a recent speech by Alan Greenspan, technology demands resulted in significant increases in high school enrollment as workers were expected to read manuals, interpret blueprints, and understand formulae. Now, my wife and I consider ourselves to be technologically astute. After all, we use email and we know how to surf the web. But this past Christmas, when our grown children were home, we realized just how much more advanced is their use of this technology. From Palm Pilots to reading the web instead of newspapers, shopping via the web, bidding for airplane tickets, to paying their bills, this next generation is already plugged in. My son recently became engaged, and he and his fiancée have a wedding website with news about the upcoming event, including a daily countdown. Due to the accelerated expansion of information technologies, which in turn have brought and will continue to bring significant changes in the workplace, there is an evolving demand for new skills in our economy. Technology is driving a metamorphosis in education and what it means to be an educated person. Success in business depends on one's ability to shorten the learning curve, anticipate the changing needs of customers, and to use critical thinking skills to understand and develop new and creative ideas. The need for critical thinking is essential in order to effectively employ the new technologies. We need critical thinkers who have the ability and responsibility to put ideas into action. As University of Utah alumnus and former Bonneville International executive Don Gale says, we have moved from the linear learning of my day to the nonlinear learning of the computer age. What is needed, in the words of Bard College president Leon Botstein, is an education that teaches you how to ask a question. The skill of critical thought, he says, is knowing what you don't know. People are drowning in information, but starved for knowledge. The sheer volume of available information is clearly impossible to handle by traditional methods. Critical thinking is what is needed. Macrocomputers can synthesize millions of bits of information into multiple simulations and possibilities. Information technology can provide the information, but critical thinking is what lifts the level of analysis to synthesis, exploration of new solutions, and the generation of new knowledge. This is very exciting, and it requires new thinking. Hugh B. Brown, who was a counselor to President David O. McKay, captured the importance of critical thinking as well as anyone I've heard. 30 years ago, in this same BYU forum, he said, One of the most important things in the world is freedom of mind. From this, all other freedoms spring. Such freedom is necessarily dangerous, for one cannot think right without running the risk of thinking wrong. But generally, more thinking is the antidote for the evils that spring from wrong thinking. More thinking is required, and we call upon you students to exercise your God-given right to think through on every proposition that is submitted to you and be unafraid to express your opinions with proper respect for those to whom you talk and proper acknowledgement of your own shortcomings. Be unafraid to express your thoughts and to insist upon your right to examine every proposition. We are not so much concerned with whether your thoughts are orthodox as we are that you shall have thoughts. President Brown's perceptive observations about the importance of independent thought move us to the next key ingredient of the educated person. In order to think critically, we must have core values. One of the best quotes on the need for this attribute comes from Elder Neil Maxwell, certainly a good friend to both BYU and the University of Utah. I quote, "When we stop acknowledging the existence of fixed value points in the scheme of things, we stop navigating by these points. And having stopped steering, to use a simple analogy, there is at first the naive, excited exclamation, 'Look, no hands.' But this will be followed by the shock realization, 'Help, no brakes.'" And President Hinckley, in an address to this forum, said, "Each day we are made increasingly aware of the fact that life is more than science and mathematics, more than history and literature. There is a need for another education, without which the substance of our secular learning may lead only to our destruction. I refer to the education of the heart, of the conscience, of the character, of the spirit. These indefinable aspects of our personalities, which determine so certainly what we are and what we do in our relationships one with another. For the educated person, the interrelationship between core values and critical thinking is fundamental. We achieve our values from many sources. Certainly, religion provides a primary source of values for most of us and must never be discounted. Educated people also learn what it means to be human through participation in and appreciation for the arts and humanities. David Denby, a New Yorker magazine film critic, went back to school as an adult to take a great books course. He found that those types of courses convey both a sense of what is human, of what a human being is and is capable of in spiritual and ethical dimensions, and also a definition of what a civil society ideally can be. At the same time, they reflect what the weaknesses and possible dangers to that civil society are. Moreover, these writings provide certain notions of what a self is, in a secular and a spiritual sense, what a citizen is, and what his or her duties and obligations are, and what society's obligations are to its citizens. Those concepts are all central to what we are. That is the traditional view, and indeed it is absolutely necessary today." End of quote. The Great Books course that Denby took includes most of what is generally recognized as the Western canon: Homer, Plato, the Bible, both the Old and New Testaments, Shakespeare, Newtonian physics, and Darwinian biology. In addition to these essential writings from the Western tradition, we are increasingly understanding the value and importance of studying Eastern and multicultural writings. It is important to understand the wide spectrum of points of view represented in such an anthology. An appreciation of the arts is also fundamental to what it means to be an educated person. To lack an education in the arts is to be profoundly disconnected from our history, from beauty, from other cultures, and from other forms of expression. A college diploma must be much more than a passport to a good job. A college education should improve the overall quality of one's life. Work consumes only a small part of our time. What we do with the remainder of our lives really defines who we are. A college experience can introduce students to many, many ways to enrich their personal lives. Museums, libraries, theaters, literature and writing courses, modern dance, athletics. A college education can open the mind to both the beauty and the wonder of our civilized culture. From such an exposure, the pursuits of a lifetime can be born. Studies show that when the arts are a strong component of the school environment, the dropout rate and absenteeism decline. The College Board reports that students who studied the arts for more than 4 years outperformed other students on the SAT. A 10-year study of community-based youth organizations found that youth participating in programs with arts activities were twice as likely to win an academic achievement award, four times more likely to participate in a science or math fair, and eight times more likely to receive a community service award. Research by the President's Committee on the Arts and Humanities confirmed that the arts help produce critical thinking and nimbleness in judgment, creativity and imagination, cooperative decision-making, leadership, high-level literacy, and communication, and the capacity for problem-posing and problem-solving. It is no accident that Professor Chris Johnson, a University of Utah professor of computer sciences and a pioneer in the application of scientific computing and visualization to problems in medicine, practiced hard as a boy to become a concert pianist, as did Bruce Bastian, who attended BYU and became the co-founder of WordPerfect. Let's summarize where we are in compiling our list of attributes for the educated person. Technological literacy, critical thinking, core values, and an appreciation for the arts and humanities are certainly all essential. I hope you can see that they are also interactive. Attainment of one attribute is interrelated to achievement in another. This is a pretty comprehensive list and would be sufficient in many aspects of society. However, there is one more characteristic I feel is needed. In order to be truly an educated person in the 21st century, one must embrace diversity and become a citizen of an increasingly global community. As I drove onto the campus this morning, I noticed these words at the entrance: "The world is our campus." What does that mean to you? Our world is shrinking, in part because of the new technologies, and in part because of the interconnectedness of the global economy. Whether it is a consideration of the planet's natural resources and the climate, or the pain and suffering of lesser developed countries, or the personal tragedies so vividly displayed via television, such as the earthquake in India last week, we are more connected to each other than ever before in history. The world is our neighborhood, and we must come to understand, appreciate, and learn to live with all our neighbors. President Hinckley has said it best. As we move into another century, we must resolve to live together in a society of men and women of diverse backgrounds, interests, and cultures. We must live with respect and tolerance and understanding one for another. We can and should retain our individuality and respect that of others, while nurturing together a great society dedicated to the blessing of all who reside here. We must, end of quote, we must learn about the races and the people of the world and of their rich cultures. We must recognize and accept that there are people with profoundly different ideas and ways of life from our own. And we must learn to be tolerant and accepting of these differences. Many of you understand what I'm saying from firsthand experience. Through church missions and studying abroad, you have been immersed in other cultures and languages. You've had the experience of stepping into a new situation where old stereotypes have had to give way to a newfound appreciation of those different from yourselves. And along the way, many of you have experienced the sting of being treated as an outsider, as someone odd and potentially threatening. Through both the positive and negative sides of such experiences, many of you have a unique appreciation for the importance of understanding and embracing people who are different than you. I encourage you to let that experience enlarge your capacity for embracing diversity. To recognize that just because someone is different does not mean they are less human, and to value the rich and varied tapestry of the human experience. I assure you, this is an essential ingredient in an education for the 21st century. We must all learn to live and work with people who see the world through different prisms than our own. And rather than be threatened by such diversity, we can enrich our lives by celebrating such diversity. And finally, as I close, I must add that this last thought should start at home. Even within our wonderful United States, there is much more to be learned about tolerance and accepting differences. Well, that's enough for today. I want to thank you all for the honor of inviting me here to share this time with you. The world is yours for the taking if you are an educated person. Thank you very much.